Listening to the Maritime Gardening Podcast, episode 78, brought to you by Betsy Seeds and Safest Gardening Products. Well, folks, today we've got the author, YouTuber, writer, lecturer, Lee Reich. Lee Reich, if you haven't, he was on the podcast last year. If you're not unaware of his track record, Lee Reich has a PhD in horticulture. He's got a background in horticulture and soil science, and even a background in chemistry. He worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Cornell University, and he's now a writer and lecturer and consultant. He's featured in the New York Times and Martha Stewart Living, numerous articles and columns. He's got a YouTube channel and actually excellent YouTube content. Just a very pleasant series of shows to watch, like something you'd watch back in the old days when there was television, like television. He's got a half dozen books on gardening. And today we're going to be talking about a book he wrote back in 2001 called Weedless Gardening. So Lee, how is it going? And how is spring shaping up in your neck of woods? Tell everybody where you live, Lee.
I live in New Paltz, New York, and that's about 90 miles up the Hudson Valley from New York City, about an hour south of Albany. And spring is coming on. I mean, I personally love this time of year because even though we get these setbacks where it's cold and or sometimes snows, I mean, this time of year, just spring just keeps moving forward no matter what. So right. I like that.
I love how there's no black flies. And back in my backyard, I get right. Flies and mosquitoes. I try to get as much done as I can before those things show up.
Yeah, day like today here was great for working outside. It was 50 degrees, sunny.
Nice.
And, not every day is going to be like this, but it keeps getting more like this.
And the condition of your soil. So, I mean, a lot of my soil is still frozen, and even some of the beds that might have a bit of thaw on top, if you go down an inch or so, it's actually just ice beneath that. What about you? So your gardens that aren't covered or anything like that, or not a greenhouse, just your exposed gardens or whatever.
Yeah.
What's the state of your thaw in those gardens?
I think the soils, I had to dig a deep hole the other day and it didn't hit any frost at all. So I guess we're defrosted. I'll be planting my peas, April 1st.
Right.
So the soil better be defrosted by then. I remember one year I had to chop through ice with a hoe to do that, but
I've done that.
I don't think that'll happen this year.
What zone are you in?
Zone 5.
So yeah, I'm in 6A. You'd think like I'd be, it just goes to show these zones don't tell you everything.
Right. Well, the zones, what the zones really are based on is how the average coldest it gets in winter.
Exactly. I think people use them as a guide for like everything. All they really tell you is how survivable things will be for given perennials. They don't really tell you the length of your growing season, how warm it's going to be, when it's going to thaw.
Right.
I have numerous comments on my YouTube channel of people that are in zone 5 and they've got this thing's thawed or that thing's thawed or so on and so forth. There's a very popular YouTube channel called One Yard Revolution. You ever seen that one?
No.
No, just Google it sometime. There's a guy in Chicago. He's in zone 5 something. And he's got a lot of plastic domes in his backyard like me. But he's got stuff growing like all the time, whereas I can't get anything to happen here. And it's colder where he is in terms of how cold
it is. Yeah, because it could be sun plus you have the maritime effect. So you don't get as cold in the winter. So that puts you in that zone 6. But you also don't get as warm in the summer.
That's right. And we also don't have any damn sun.
Right, that would be a big factor.
Foggy and overcast, and we have the foggy, overcast winters. So I'd rather be 10 degrees colder and sunny. Whatever.
Likewise.
So yeah, it certainly is a challenge when you've got, even in the height of summer here, we'll have a lot of days where the sun really doesn't break through till noon because of all this fog rolling in from the ocean.
Right. Well, you could probably grow really good cold crops like cabbage and broccoli and Brussels sprouts, and maybe you could grow artichokes even. No?
I haven't tried artichokes, but all those brassicas you mentioned grow fine, and
lettuce, peas,
yeah, potatoes. No, but certainly, and you just sort of adapt to what you work with, what you can. I find peppers an extraordinary challenge here.
Right.
All right. So
I can make a recommendation, because peppers used to be hard for me to grow. Then I started planting a variety called Italian Sweet or Sweet Italia. And it seems to ripen. I mean, we do have more sun and heat, but of all the peppers I've ever tried, it seems to ripen the earliest and do the best under, you know, less than ideal, meaning more southerly conditions.
Sweet Italia?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm writing that down. I'll see if I can get a hold of some of those. Still got a bit of time. All right, great. Now, one thing that for those that tune into, if you're homesick someday or you want to binge watch something, I would really recommend you check out Lee's YouTube channel. It's very pleasant to watch. I can tell the production value of your videos is much better than mine. They look sort of professionally edited and so on.
They actually were. I had a friend that was doing it, and that's what he does for a living. And he's done PBS videos, so you know he's definitely a professional.
They actually do. You know what? They actually do watch like PB. Like if you watch this old house or Victory Garden, they do sort of roll out a bit like that. Very pleasant, nice music, and upbeat and sort of cheery. And I think they capture your personality well. Yeah. Or it's mine, or it's just like, hey, I'm just a guy in my backyard with a camera. But I've got 240.
I guess I'll have to check mine out.
No, they're very well done. Anyway, there's a couple of videos where you mentioned that, it's not a garden, it's a farm den. So, and it's something you mention in various bits of your writing. Could you contrast for us what that term means and how you would distinguish that from a garden?
Yeah, well, when I started out, when I bought this house, I had a property of 3/4 acre, and I had a garden in back, and it was very manageable. And then I was always lusting for this field just to the south of me, and then eventually I did buy it. So that was another 2 acres.
Right. Well, and, only a gardener would understand the concept of lusting for a field.
Right, and that's when things got out of hand, because I grow for instance, I grow hardy kiwi vines, and since I write about gardening, I'd like to study different varieties and see how they do. So I had 2 hardy kiwi vines when I had a garden, and after I bought the field, I planted 20.
Right,
and same thing, then I planted chestnuts, and I also grow pawpaw trees.
In 20s?
I planted 20 of them. I had 2, but then when I got so I was just making, planting on and on. So then I all of a sudden hit me one day that this is no longer a garden. But then I was thinking also, it's not really a farm either.
Right.
Cause it's not big enough, and I don't make a living from it. I do sell a few things. So I said it was a farm den. And that was it.
I think my setup, I got about a 25, my garden's about the same size as Root's desk, so about 2,500 square feet, give or take, maybe a little bit bigger. And I think my wife certainly calls it a farm, but it's not as big as yours.
My vegetable gardens it's 2 gardens and the greenhouse, probably 2,500 square feet, but I grow a lot of fruits also. And I have a hay field that I use for hay to feed the compost or the mulch with, so I have nut trees and all sorts of things growing here.
That's another, this is all stuff you speak about in your book. And for those that haven't read it, Lee mentioned that when I did the podcast with Lee last year, he mentioned this book and he sent it to me and I read it. I really enjoyed reading it. It's a really good book for either the beginner gardener that say I want to have a garden and I don't know a thing, and it's probably a great way to start off, because you don't get you don't get your mind poisoned by the conventional gardening. You sort of start off with Lee's approach to gardening is very similar to my own. He does a sort of no-till, weedless type approach. But also, even for the experienced gardener that wants to get out of tilling their garden every year and They've heard about gardening without tilling and that sort of thing, and maybe they want to change gears. This is a good book because it walks through how to do it, why to do it in a very accessible way. So why don't, for the sake of the listeners, Lee, why don't you contrast your concept, explain your concept of weedless gardening, and then contrast that with the sort of conventional gardening that we're, certainly I was raised that way. My father would rent a rototill every year and, you know, put right. 6, 12, 12 on the, all that sort of stuff. So can you contrast those two approaches? Explain your approach and contrast it with conventional gardening.
Yeah. So right from the get-go, my approach is different. And I remember when I first started my first garden, I actually dug it by hand. And when you, it was lawn, so you dig it by, so the conventional approach is you dig it up and then you got to wait a couple of weeks while biological activity sort of calms down and things break down a little. Then you dig it up again to make it, because it doesn't totally break down, you got to wait another 2 weeks and then you plant. So my approach for starting the garden is to just kill the vegetation in place, whether it's weeds or grass or whatever. And I start that by just getting everything down to the ground by mowing or by knocking it down. Then I cover with paper. You could use newspaper, there's landscape paper. Put wet the paper, put some compost on the top where I'm gonna plant, and wood chips for this path, and then just plant. I can plant right away. So that's a big difference in starting it. First of all, it's quicker. Yeah. Secondly, it preserves the soil structure. Yeah. You know, beneath a lawn, lawn grass especially has very extensive fine root system and really makes the soil have good tilth. So it sort of seems to me criminal to till it up and ruin that good structure. Mm-hmm. So by just killing the grass in place, you preserve that structure. And in addition, there's a lot of other benefits. You preserve organic matter. And then for ongoing maintenance, the conventional approach is, you know, at the end of the year, you till everything. And my approach is I have permanent laid out beds and paths in my gardens. And I just lay compost on the beds and wood chips or some other weed-free organic material in the paths. And that's it. Very so it's simpler.
Very similar.
It preserves. Yeah, and it's simpler. It preserves organic matter, which is very important. And it also, this is why my book is called Weedless Gardening, because it also doesn't promote weed growth. When you till a soil, you expose the soil to light, and weed seeds are dormant, waiting for light to awaken. So basically, when you till the soil, you're sowing weed seeds.
Exactly. Yeah.
Coaxing them to grow. So that's how I got started on this whole thing. Is I decided to just stop tillage, and then I realized I can't just stop tillage because the soil will get compacted from walking on it and rolling wheelbarrows and all that. So then I just decided to put the soil on permanent planting beds. And it doesn't have to be raised beds. They can be flat on the ground. So I had permanent areas for planting, permanent areas for walking, and that was 90% there. And you know, there's a couple other things, part of the system I described in the book. But it works really well. Matter of fact, when I first started out, it worked so well that after a couple of years, I was thinking maybe there was something wrong with my soil because I wasn't getting any weeds or enough weeds. And then I realized the system's working. That's what's happening.
Yeah, I think there's a major misconception among a lot. I mean, I work in an office with people, and when they say I don't sell my garden, they look at me like I'm lying.
Right. It's, you know, it's always been this, you know, tilling has been such a tradition. And it's always been the sign of a good gardener or farmer to have this nicely tilled, you know, garden or farm in spring or in fall. And it's hard to break that tradition. I always tell people if they really feel like, you know, because tilling also, I think, makes people, first of all, you get to go outside and get your blood moving in the spring. And maybe you feel like you're doing some good, so you get the feeling of righteousness. And I always tell people if this is, you know, the case, why don't they just set aside a 2-foot by 2-foot area, and this will be their tilling area, and till it to their heart's content, and leave the regular garden untilled, and then but make sure you weed that tilling area because you're going to get a lot of weeds there too.
I always say that planting potatoes helps you deal with your tilling withdrawal, because, you know, in the process of removing the potatoes, you usually have to turn it over a little bit to get the ones that are, you know, I plant my potatoes about 8 inches deep.
Oh.
And, so, I put them, but my soil is loose, and I literally just twist my hand down until it's at the wrist, and then I put about a foot of mulch on top of the soil, and I don't do anything at all the whole season. And then when it's time to harvest them, I just push the mulch aside and dig them out. Then I don't plant potatoes in that garden bed for 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Right.
So yeah, that's the way I sort of tilling withdraw. Because you kind of hand tilling, I usually just go through my hands, but I have to admit that secretly I do sort of enjoy, oh, look at that, it's all brown and even, and so on. So Lee, I noticed in leafing through your book, you mentioned a number of well-recognized no-till gurus like Ruth Stout and people along those lines, but you don't mention the great grandfathers of permaculture, Bill Mollison, David Holmgren, or even use the word permaculture. Why do you stay away from describing what you do as that?
Well, permaculture entails a lot of things, integrating animals into the landscape, you know, how you plant, what kinds of plants, how you integrate them together, water collection. So there's a lot going on with permaculture. And one aspect of permaculture is that they do not disturb the soil. And that would be similar to what I'm advocating. But even that, they're a little different in their approach there, because they tend to use cardboard to smother or to keep weeds at bay. And I actually don't like to use cardboard, because when I put mulch on, well, when I start a garden and I do put down paper and then compost or mulch on top, I just want that paper to last as long as it takes to kill the vegetation underneath.
Like a month or so.
Yeah, about a month or so. And then, because I want to really have a continuity of, I'm trying to emulate natural systems.
Yeah.
So in natural systems, you have the surface of the soil is high in undigested organic materials. And then as you move down, it's more and more digested, and you get this horizontation of the soil. And okay. I think it just that cardboard can last. I mean, people have told me sometimes it lasts 2 years, depending on the weather.
When I first colonized the area on my property, which is the garden, it was just a giant weed area, just like a field, I guess, a field of weeds. And certainly the walking paths, I just cardboarded the whole thing. I cardboarded the whole area except for the garden beds initially. And then as time went by, I started, developing the space inside there. So I would dig up where I had basically cardboard with wood chips on top of it. And so I'd have an area like that. So I'm going to turn this space into a garden. I'd move the wood chips back and it'd still be cardboard there. So you're right. It does take, I've heard people say it breaks down fast, but no, I've seen it last a year or more. Sure.
It depends on the weather condition, how much rain you get, a lot of things. But so the paper works well. You know, the thing is, even if you just lay wood chips on top of plastic mulch, you know, which people often do to make it look prettier, you do get weeds. You might be smothering out all the weeds coming up from below, but weeds colonize the mulch from above.
That's right. They'll go along. So depending on the type of weed, I mean, the plastic will capture water in just a way that the weed loves.
Yeah.
What's that called? Coltsfoot. Coltsfoot, right. The coltsfoot is like, hey, this is the greatest thing ever. I've got totally, you can get on top of it. It's like, I've got run of the show here, and coltsfoot will colonize some of the even more invasive weeds, for sure.
Yeah.
I've helped people with their gardens before, and they put all that that black landscaping fabric down, and then put mulch over it in their flower garden, and there's just like an infinite number of weeds rooted right into that land. I find that stuff to be just about the most useless stuff you can have.
Right. And also, I think there's, besides being useless, the thing I don't like about it is if you ever want to change what you've done, you know, planting wise, it's you have that tough plastic material, just a woven material just buried in the soil. And it's really a pain to get out, especially with the roots growing in. And then the biggest thing, I think it's disrespectful to the soil. Exactly. I don't like to put anything in the soil that, you know, that shouldn't be there.
It's not any added, it's no added value. You know, like if the soil can't make any use of it, and you're basically diminishing the way the various organisms in the soil can interact with the mulch above by putting this sort of, it's not like things can't get through it, but it's certainly right. A barrier of a kind, right?
Yeah. And it's there, not necessarily permanently, but it's there in a way that's hard to get rid of it if you do want to get rid of it.
Yes. If you want to get rid of it, you're going to ruin one of your afternoons getting rid of it. It's not a fun afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, if it's been in place for a long time, it's going to have roots growing through it and all sorts of things going on. It'd just be a mess.
Incredibly tenacious.
Yeah.
For something that's not alive, it's incredibly tenacious.
Right.
All right, so let's move on to one thing that Lee and I are different about. Is that Lee, and I thought this would be useful for my listeners that use this approach, is that, I mean, people have been listening to me, I basically start just about everything outdoors and I don't do transplants. If I have some catastrophe and I have to have transplants, I just buy them. But most years I get away with maybe 99% of my garden being direct seeded, despite having a fairly short season. But Lee, I'm sure he gets things earlier than me, does, you know, has a fairly, you have a greenhouse, yes?
Yep.
And you also have some sort of lighting situation inside your house as well?
No.
Oh, everything's in the greenhouse?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's better in a lot of ways, I guess, because you're getting the full spectrum of light. So Lee does transplants.
Right. I used to have a lighting system in the house, but after I got the greenhouse, I thought might as well not burn the electricity, just use a greenhouse.
And is your greenhouse heated at all?
Yeah, minimally.
Minimal.
It's heated. It's like a Mediterranean climate in the greenhouse. It's cool, moist winters and hot, dry summers.
And do you like have
it gets down into the 30s.
Do you have something to keep it from freezing in there, like just in case, like or is it, does it just maintain itself?
Oh no, it has to. It gets down to 20 below here, 20 below Fahrenheit,
right?
Outside here, so in the greenhouse, I have to have a supplemental heat. Yeah, it's a propane heater.
You have a little heater there to keep it.
Well, it's not that little.
Right.
At least price wise.
Yes, I can imagine. Right. So Lee starts a good number of his, and also just for optimizing your yield and stuff like that, he does transplants. And what page is that? Like page of the book, page 122 to 124. Something I found really interesting is that he made a table that suggests sowing dates. And also sowing dates both for transplants and things you're planting directly. Although you can talk more a little bit. I'll get Lee to explain this a little bit more as we go on here. But sowing dates and also when to plant things out, depending on when your average spring frost is. And for those that are interested, I've worked with Lee to develop a table in Excel, Microsoft, if you have that on your computer, a Microsoft Excel file, which has this table on it. And it's basically got a whole bunch of different varieties of vegetable, from A to T sort of thing, arugula to turnip. And what you can do on this table is punch in your average spring frost date and your average fall frost date. And depending on what date you put in, it'll give you all those planting dates for all those varieties of plants. And it suggests the earliest planting date and also the latest, but where appropriate. In some things, it doesn't really work that way because they just take too long, like celery, for instance. There's no late planting date. You got to start early or you're just not going to get celery. But you know, for certain things like arugula, right, or spinach, you can plant it late and have a fall crop. So the table suggests when would be the latest you might want to do that. And actually, your times, just looking at the table, aren't too far off of, I would think, of middle of August. Your table suggests something like middle of August for planting arugula and things like that, and similar to where I am. Same with
spinach. So it's the earliest date you could do it for, you know, a spring or a summer crop, and then the latest planting date is for the fall garden. Obviously, if you plant it too late, then things won't ripen in time. So the latest planting date, you know, after that date, you just shouldn't do it.
So if you're listening in and you're sitting in front of your computer, you can go in the description box of this, or you can go to Lee's website. I'll have some links and stuff like that. And you can bring this thing up while Lee's talking, so you can sort of see what he's talking about. Of course, if you're in your car listening to this on your work, you're just going to have to look it up when you get home, or if you've got a, you know, a nice cushy job, maybe look it up when you get to work. anyway, depending on your situation. So Lee, explain your reason for creating this table, and if you can sort of do it in words, you know, what you were getting at in creating. I think it's a really useful resource for gardeners, especially gardeners that are going to, when do I start? You know, a lot of people I talk to will say, like, when should I start getting my tomatoes going? When should I start my peppers? When should I start this? When should I start that? And this table is aimed at the, in a lot of ways, a transplant gardener. So can you just talk us through it a little bit?
Yeah, I think if you really want to get the most from, say, your vegetable garden, I think timing is crucial. And people, you know, like sometimes people say around here, they might say, well, you know, they put the, it always bothers me when they say they're going to put their garden in Memorial Day, which here is end of June. No, end of May.
Yeah, we call that Victoria. That's the Queen's birthday here in the colonies. The same. There we go. It's so, also called the May 2-4 weekend. It's you usually have the Monday off, and most people drink a lot of beer.
So most people. So it sort of bothers me when they say they're putting their garden in, because really there's things you can and should plant before then, and things you can plant after then, and should plant after then. And it totally discounts, like, you know, a fall garden. I'm a big fan of the fall garden. If people don't realize that, you know, after tomatoes and peppers start to wane, if you have your timing right, and you sow these plants, you can have as you know, cucumbers, tomatoes, and peppers are sort of fading out, you could have this lush green garden of cabbage and kale and spinach and lettuce and celery. So it's really good to get the timing right, but you have to know when to do it. So I made this table, and for this table, I joined a lot of reading and a lot of my own experience, and it basically, when to plant is really geared by the average date of the last frost in spring and the first frost in fall. So what Greg has done is he's made the table. In my book, I have the table, and you can figure it out, but he's made it even easier, where you just put in those two dates, which you can get from your cooperative extension office. Is that what they call that there?
I would go, I'll provide a link where you can go to get it from Canada. You can get it from our sponsor, Vesti Seeds. They have all those time for whatever province you are in Canada. And it basically by major city, lists about three major cities per province. There's other, I'm sure they're getting it from somewhere else, probably from, I'm not exactly sure where.
Agriculture Canada.
Probably Agriculture Canada, exactly.
Yeah. So you put in those dates, and then all you got to do is look at the table and, you know, pick the vegetables you want to plant, and it tells you when the earliest planting date is and when the latest planting date is.
Right.
And from the book, you actually have to sort of count back numbers of weeks, but using the table, it just says it right there. So it's quite easy and quite useful.
Yeah. And for the transplants, you'll have on the table, you'll see one or two or three or four asterisks next to the plant that suggests, so that basically is suggesting you should transplant this. And it's basically, depending on how many asterisks there are, it's different suggestions for the table will give you a planting date, a sowing date for starting it indoors, and then the asterisks will tell you when to plant it out. I guess relative to when you know all risk of frost is
right. Over. Yeah, a lot of people like to go with their gut in gardening, which I don't agree with. Say, you know, if it's where I am, the last spring frost is a little after the middle of May, and you know, if you go with your gut, sometimes we get a little warm spell in February even, and if you decide, okay, I'm going to sow tomatoes because it's getting warm already, you're going to have really leggy plants that will be too big to transplant smoothly into the garden when it's time to transplant them. Or you might just go with your gut and plant the tomatoes out too early. So I think this table is useful for you know, reining in those impulsive plantings.
I think a lot of people do start things a bit early, and also and I am not immune to putting things out too early and being too brazen and too brave. You know, strange. I mean, last year we had an insanely weird year where, you know, we had a June frost, and it wiped out the leaves on my grape plants. And, you know, all my, by that point, I think my 1st of June, I had taken, I've got these sort of like portable plastic domes in my garden, and I had them. So just like I did this year, I sowed my kale and stuff like that under those, like around this time of year. So instead of doing transplants, I do that. I just left the domes on to make it a bit warmer in there, and they were doing really well. And then I took the domes off those gardens around the end of May, and I put them on other gardens to direct seed my squash to get those things sort of jump-started. And most years, that's fine. But last year, we had this weird frost in June. And the beets, Swiss chard, kale, everything but the lettuce and spinach was just flattened. It didn't kill the plants, but it probably, all the plants in those categories lost, I would say, 70% of their foliage. And they came back. But plants that you would think that were tough, like people are always saying how tough Swiss chard is. it was like someone took a blowtorch to the garden. The only plants that withstood that cold was the spinach and lettuce. Those are the toughest plants. and peas. The peas were okay as well.
Yeah. I mean, it also depends on how the plants are growing. If they're growing under very, you know, lush, succulent conditions, and possibly because you had them in the domes, they might have been a little lusher and softer growing than if they had been outside.
They were tender.
So not acclimated to the cold as much.
Tender babies.
Yeah.
That's, you know, yep. That is a good point, because the spinach had been exposed for, I mean, the spinach was started off that way too, but yeah, I think it had been exposed a bit longer. But even I sowed tomatoes in the middle of May outside in a cold frame. They were growing great. They were probably, I would say, 10 inches high in the middle of June. And I came out the day after that frost and they were literally gone. Like, it is like they'd just been vaporized.
Wow.
Like, despite the cold frame, like, the cold frame almost needed another layer of plastic over it. But it was a unique year. Not all years are like that. So, but anyway, right. the whole point is that I've certainly had years where, you know, I was at the, you know, the garden center, and I was buying seeds. And, you know, let's say it's the middle of May for where I am is a bit early to be planting things out. But I've had years where, it's like a Saturday and it's May 15th and it's warm and it's nice. And you just, well, geez, how could it possibly get cold after a day like today? And you go and buy a couple dozen transplants and put them in the garden, and then they're all dead.
This table, or that sort of highlights some important point with respect to this table, that, you know, a lot of gardening of when to set stuff out is based on averages. So in an average year, these are the correct planting dates.
Yeah.
Of course, no year is exactly the average, but since you don't know the future, you have to go with averages.
Well, that's the weird thing. I noticed on at least the resource that is provided by VESEs, they give a range. So for like Halifax, I can't remember what it is now, but they don't give you a particular date. They'll say it's between, you know, May. I'm just going to pick a number off the top of my head. Don't quote me on this. They'll say between May 15th and May 21st, for instance. They don't actually give a particular date. They give a range. So for anyone out there, I would err on the conservative side and just pick the later. Right.
Well, because a 1 week, you know, 1 week delayed planting of a seed, for instance, or even setting out of a transplant, doesn't mean a 1 week delay in harvest if it's during the cool season.
That's right.
Because the one that was planted first doesn't grow that much if it's cooled out.
No, it just waits, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Or even if it's, yeah, if it's too cool, the roots may be a bit bothered by the planting out.
Yeah.
I should ask you, since I got you on here, I have found, and like, you know, I direct seed everything, but certain things I have found are really, really, I mean, you mentioned things like parsnips and carrots and stuff like that, but I have found squash in particular. I mean, I direct seed my squash and I get a pretty good yield, but I have found them very difficult. I often give people the advice, they hate being transplanted. I assume because your book suggests that they get transplanted. What is your trick for that?
They do hate being transplanted, but the things you have to do it carefully. First of all, you don't start them off in small containers that you have to keep moving to a larger container.
Right.
So typically I'll start them in 4-inch pots. And, you know, when they're ready to transplant, the roots should really fill the pot nicely, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And then when you just tip them out of the pot, you just don't disturb the roots at all and just ease it right into the ground. So, I mean, ideally the plant doesn't even know it's been moved.
Ideally, yeah, exactly, yeah. So the solution is to not have them in those little tiny things, but to have them,
right.
You know, don't go cheap on the pots or the,
yeah, and then water. Make sure to keep up with watering it once they're in the ground, just because for the first few days before the roots start growing into the surrounding soil, it's basically as if it's in a pot. So if you're watering a pot every day, you'd have to water that almost every day.
Right. Right, until it starts to send out, you know, starts to send the roots out further.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's. Is there anything else you wanted to speak to with regard to this table?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. It's pretty self-explanatory, especially with your great thing they have on the web.
Gee, thanks. So we'll put that up. I'll put it up on my thing. Leo put it up on his thing. There's a little graphic near the top, which has a hyperlink to Lee's website if you want to buy his book, Weedless Gardening. Of course, it's got a hyperlink to the Maritime Gardening Podcast if you want to listen to any one of the other 76 podcasts I have. You can even listen, if you haven't listened to, I did a podcast with Lee last, was it fall?
I can't remember when it was, but yeah, exactly. That sounds about right.
I think we did one or two, or I might have divided it up into two. So, if you're interested in that, you can check that out as well. Lee, I want to thank you for coming on the show again. I'm really and thank you for sending me this book. Again, Weedless Gardening, the Hassle-Free All-Organic System. I don't plug things that I'm not interested in. This is definitely... I found it worth reading, you know, so it's definitely worth a leaf through. And it's not, how long is it? Some people care, but I always think it's about, I don't know, 180 pages of reading, give or take. I basically read this whole thing. This was just in the bathroom in the magazine rack, and it just basically, that's how I digest books while I'm doing the other end of my digestion. It's my preferred way to read. I know the odd time I'd take it with me and sit on the couch and read. But it's definitely the kind of, I find books like gardening books, the kind of books that you want to sort of reread. Instructional books, I like to, maybe it's just a student in me, but I don't like reading at once. I like rereading things and coming back to stuff and just mulling them over. So it's definitely a book that's worth mulling over. So
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show, and thanks also for making that the table that I thought was quite useful in the book even more useful on the web.
Yeah, no, it's actually inspired me to think about doing something like this for other sorts of things. I just there's got to be a way to put this algorithm to work.
Right.
It's just a question of imagination and what could be added. So perhaps going forward, there'll be I can broaden this thing out and add more to it, so on and so forth. Add other kinds of useful things. Anyway, more to come on that. Everybody, thanks for listening. Lee, thanks for coming on the show. Hope we can have you on again.
And yeah, I would love that.
Hey, that's great, and I look forward to that. Everybody out there, if you enjoy the podcast, if you enjoy the YouTube channel, check out the offer from my sponsors in the description box or in the show notes. There's coupon codes there. If you need something for your garden and they sell it, buy from them and help support the YouTube channel, help support the podcast and everything I'm doing here. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, please like, share, subscribe. And until next time, get out there, get at it, have fun in your garden, and thanks for listening.